Galaxy and If, we'll just kind of jump ahead to Galaxy and If, and we'll bounce around. I feel no need to be constrained by temporal order. Galaxy and If, how did you end up being an editor at Galaxy?
Well, I'd been writing for Galaxy when Horace Gould was the editor, and I did a lot of writing. I think I was the most frequently published writer in Galaxy when Horace was the editor. And he had problems. He had a breakdown during his service in World War II and was still suffering from what is called agoraphobia, fear of large spaces.
Uh-huh.
So he never left his house, or almost never left his house. And then he began leaving his house, and I'd come around. I had a car, and I'd come around and pick him up and drive him around so he'd have the experience of being out of the house for a while. And he would get very nervous as I was driving him. And he would do things like saying, "Do you have any gum, Fred?" And I'd say, "No, I don't chew gum." And he said, "You sure you don't have any gum? Let me look in the glove compartment. There might be some gum there." And he was really very ill at ease, but he did it. And then he had a car accident, a taxi accident, which didn't really do him any great physical damage, except he hurt his leg and it had to be treated for a while. But then he began having a lot of trouble concentrating on what he was doing. And he had an apartment in New York City where he did all his work. And I'd go to his apartment, and there'd be two or three rooms full of manuscripts that people had sent in that he hadn't been able to make himself go ahead and read. So he finally asked me to read for him, so I read all those manuscripts and sent most of them back and passed some of them on to him. Then he got a little sicker, and he asked me if I would write some editorials for him because he didn't feel quite up to it. And then I made up couple issues of the magazine from scratch because he couldn't do anything at all. And then finally he was hospitalized, and I began editing the magazine, first without my name on the masthead, and then when it became clear he wasn't coming back, they put my name on the masthead. And that's how I came to be the editor.
You became the editor by osmosis.
Exactly, yeah. I grew into it slowly, like fungus on a shower curtain.
In the early 1950s, when Galaxy came along, Galaxy was quite a different magazine from anything else that was out there. It was consciously designed to be that. Could you give us a little background about the magazines that were out and why Galaxy, or how Galaxy, was different?
Well, Galaxy wanted to talk more about the society of the future than about ray guns and rocket ships. It didn't always work out that way for the stories, because editors can say what they want, and writers will still write what they feel like writing anyhow. So you don't have that much control over it. But to a considerable extent, Galaxy was a magazine that dealt with what society was going to do and be in the future. And with a lot more comedy. A lot of the writing was satirical, and so Galaxy was funnier to read than most of the others, and also more discouraging, because the futures were usually ones you didn't want to live in. But that was what Horace did, and it worked out pretty well. He published some really fine stories. He had two or three of the best short story writers who ever lived writing for him: Cyril Cornbluth, Damon Knight, Robert Sheckley, and they were all right at the peak of their form at that time, and he was publishing it all. So it was a good magazine to read, and it was a good magazine to write for, except that Horace, of course, like all editors, was crazy. I mean,
you say that, yeah, as an editor.
Yeah, well, you had to bear in mind, John Campbell, once when I was editing Galaxy and he was still editing Astounding, we were at a party of a mutual friend who was a mathematician from Bell Labs, and I got there early, and John came leaping across the room when he came in and saw me and grabbed me by the lapel and said, "Fred, do you know that every science fiction editor who does not work at science with his hands goes crazy within 2 years?" And I said, "What science do you work at with your hands, John?" Actually, he was a ham radio operator, and he claimed that counted, but I've never accepted it.
You should point out that that would be engineering, not science.
Except that you never pointed out anything to John. I mean, that was never possible. John was a wonderful editor, by the way. I learned more from him than from anybody else. I slavishly copied some of the things he did. But he was crazy, too. I'll give you an example. You interviewed Hal Clement.
Uh-huh.
I was Hal's...
Harry is how I call
him. Yeah. That's his name, Harry Smith. I was Harry's agent for some years, and he turned in a manuscript called Mission of Gravity, which I read and perceived immediately that it belonged in Astounding.
Yeah.
So I messengered it over.
No, you were his agent.
I was Harry's literary agent.
You were editing Galaxy. Were you editing Galaxy?
A different time. Different time, okay. So I sent it over to John, and after a while I got it back from him saying, this is a wonderful, wonderful story, but you can see that it doesn't break as a serial. I wish I could publish it, but there's no way that I can do it. This was lunacy. I knew this was lunacy. So I took the manuscript. It was 300 pages long. I flipped over to page 100 and marked it. Flipped over to page 200 and marked it. Gave it to my secretary and said, retype a few pages before and after and mark it part two and part three. And then I put it in the drawer for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, because it was going to take a while for him to do the rewrite, right, so it would break.
And I sent it back to John. I didn't say anything had been done. I just said, how do you like it now? And he loved it. And it was one of the most successful serials he ever read. See, the thing is, when you're dealing with editors, you have to help them overcome their stupidity from time to time.
That's good. That's good. Well, acting as a literary agent, were you ever at a time where you were an agent and a magazine editor?
No.
Okay.
I did edit the Star Science Fiction Stories series for Ian Ballantyne, which was the first series of original anthology, because Ian asked me to do it.
But you were never in a situation where you were having to decide, do I want to draw this into my magazine or send it to my competitors?
Well, no. And I really didn't want to do it with the Star series either, but Ian was persuasive, and also he gave me a much bigger budget than anybody else had, so I could get the cream of the crop.
Yeah, well,
partly because I was handling a lot of the writers. But when I published them in Star, I didn't take any commissions.
Mm.
But there are some editors who have functioned as agents simultaneously, but it's a bad situation. You can't avoid conflict of interest.
Yeah. You never quite know, and even if you're trying hard not to be.
Right.
You never quite know, were you really... Whose interests are you looking out for? And try as hard as you might, at the back of your mind or at the back of your writer's mind, was this really the best decision for me?
Yeah.
You mentioned the Star line, which you did for Ian Ballantyne. What was it about the Star line of stories that made them so good and so memorable? Because those are still rather legendary.
Well, I could mention that had
the quality,
very perceptive editor.
Yeah, well, there's that, but
there was also the fact that Ian gave me this big budget. I was paying twice as much as any of the magazines, so there was no problem about having a selection of the stories. And the writers really reacted to that. The way it came about was that Ian and I became friendly early on. In fact, I'd known him when he was at Bantam. Ian started everything in paperback, He was also the first president of Bantam.
Yeah.
And so when he started his own company, we were already pretty friendly. And I sold him some science fiction of my own, a couple novels and things. And the other novels, I was an agent, as I say, and I sold them stuff by other people. And he said, I would like to get all of the science fiction writers to know who I am. With a new company, nobody had heard of it. How do I do that? I said, I know how to do that. Give them money. For example, you can publish an anthology and send them all a little check for the story.
Yeah.
He said, good, but let's not do reprints. Let's have them do new stories. So that was what started the series.
Wow.
Ian was a wonderful man.
Yeah, I heard that. We interviewed Tom Dougherty yesterday.
Yeah.
And he knew Ian very well. And had lots of stories. And in fact, he said, be sure to ask Fred, because you're about Ian Ballantyne. Yeah, because it seemed like Ian and Betty Ballantyne were just incredibly influential, but most readers don't recognize that, other than there's a book line that says Ballantyne.
That's right. That's about all they do now. But Ian invented paperback publishing. Almost all the lines that exist now were his creation. They didn't do nonfiction until he began doing it. They didn't do originals. They didn't do stories that people had written for them until he began doing it. Before he began Bantam, in fact, for some time after he began Bantam, there were no stories sold to Bantam. They were sold to a hardback publisher, and the publisher would sell them to Bantam. So Ian learned how to cut out the middleman, which is why he left Bantam. The hardback publishers who owned it didn't like that, so I said, go away. And he started Ballantine Books.
Wow.
He was a genius. The difficulty is, it was not always easy to know what Ian was talking about. Because he sort of talked at 90 degrees to the subject. And you had to listen carefully. And then you would find that you were getting pearls thrown before you. But a little difficult to comprehend.
Just because he was racing 90 miles an hour and going that way.
Exactly right.
And even though he's going that way, he's still pulling you in the direction you want to go faster than anybody else would have pulled you.
Great man, great man. He was a good friend, and his death was a mortal blow. I was very sorry about it. Betty's a good friend, too, but I don't see her very much anymore because she spends her winters where any sensible person would, on the islands. You know.
Down in the Caribbean?
Yeah, yeah.
To live the life.
Incidentally, there's a book that I wrote with Jack Williamson called The Reefs of Space.
Yeah.
And if you can get your hands on a copy of the first edition, there is a beautiful nude on the cover, and that's Betty Ballantine.
Okay, interview's over. I'm going to the dealer's room. I will keep my eyes peeled, as it were.
It's also the only book that I've ever had rousted for pornography by the police department of somewhere in Indiana. I've forgotten which city. And it's all because of the cover.
Yeah, they didn't read. They just saw.
Picked up every copy on sale in that city.
Actually, the publicity for that probably really helped the sales the next week.
Maybe. I just had to go to the next city to buy a copy. Right?
Yeah, how much did you pay the police to get them to do that? Thinking about Galaxy magazine back in the early 50s. Actually, there's a hole between the early 40s when you were editing two magazines and Galaxy in the 50s. In between there, that's when you really started writing and things?
Well, yes and no. There was a war in there which took care of
some. Yeah, well, that sort of slowed things down. What did you do in the war? I mean, it's really amazing to me to realize some of the
I was a weatherman.
People.
I was a weatherman with the, well, first in Oklahoma at the Eniard Air Force Base, then with the 456 bomb group in a town called Stornara in Italy. And then the headquarters people noticed that I'd been a magazine editor, so they dragged me out of the bomb group and took me to headquarters to write public relations and stuff like that, which I really didn't want. I mean, I was very happy with the bomb group. I wasn't getting killed. I wasn't a pilot or a navigator like Harry.
Yeah.
I mean, I flew one mission, but, you see, I couldn't really do it very well. I was a good shot, so I would have worked fine with the machine guns. But I was wearing glasses at that time, and you cannot wear glasses and an oxygen mask simultaneously. So I had my choice between seeing and breathing.
Oh, that's a hard one. That's a hard one.
Anyway,
but no,
that's what I did during the war.
Sometimes is when you talk to writers who have been working in that time, and you find things, you know, like Hal Clement had been a bomber pilot, and, you know, other people had been doing weather in Italy or the Pacific, and then you had things like Sprague de Camp and Heinlein and Asimov and others back doing Navy research. And
oh, one other thing about them. I was with the 456 bomb group. Harry Hal Clements was, I think, the 459th, which means they had originally been in the same bomb wing, but somehow they got a divorce, and his went to England and mine went to Italy.
Uh-huh.
And I've never figured out why.
Now, did being in the war, did that slow down your writing and stuff?
Oh, it stopped it almost completely. I wrote a few stories while I was still in America. Once I got to Italy, I just didn't write any science fiction at all.
Probably had other things on your mind.
Well, not that much. I had spare time because a weatherman doesn't really work very hard, you know. It's just that he has to be available all the time. So I actually wrote a novel. I was homesick for New York, and I thought I would write a novel about New York City. And I thought I would write about the most sexy thing I could think of in New York, which would be the advertising business. So I wrote a complete novel called For Some We Loved, which is a quotation from Nuru Boya. And I finished it in Stornara, Italy. And then the war came to an end. I got home, and I had an apartment in Greenwich Village, and I took the manuscript out, looked at it, and I perceived that it had a serious flaw. I didn't know anything about advertising.
Well, this could slow things down.
So I picked up the Sunday Times and looked in the Help Wanted and got a job as an advertising copywriter and stayed in the business for about 4 years. I didn't do a lot of science fiction writing then either because I was learning my trade as an advertising person. But I did take that manuscript out once. I had a summer house in upstate New York over the reservoir and had a big stone fireplace. And I stayed up all one Saturday night reading the manuscript and throwing it page by page into the fire.
Oh.
Because it had another flaw. It stank.
Well, beyond that.